Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Janet Yellen's letter to the president today in five words or less, time for me to go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 20th of November. Good as always to have you here, everybody. We begin today with a departure we all kind of knew was coming after President Trump decided not to reappoint Janet Yellen to a second term chairing the Federal Reserve. Yellen said in a letter to the president today she will be leaving the Fed completely once her successor is confirmed. She could have stayed for another 7 years the way the terms of the Board of Governors are set up, but no. And therein, by the way, lie some changes coming for the Fed. Gina Smilak covers the Federal Reserve for Bloomberg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We should say here it would have been more unusual, right, if Chair Yellen had elected to stick around after she was no longer the chair?
Absolutely. I think that's totally fair. If she had chosen to stay around, it would have, I think, created a sort of unusual dynamic in the committee with both the former leader and then a new chair in place. Right. And so I think it makes sense that she left.
Now, though, come February when she leaves, there will be four seats out of the seven on the Board of Governors open. Tell me what that means.
Yeah, and it could be even earlier than February because she announced today that she'll be stepping down when her successor is appointed. And yes, so four openings on the Board of Governors out of seven chairs means that Donald Trump can essentially completely reshape the institution. And it also means that a very small number of governors is going to have to split up a huge amount of work because these guys are tasked not only with setting monetary policy, but also with really running this massive organization with everything from financial regulation to cash management.
And oh, so much more, right? I mean, they are a major banking regulator in this economy.
It's important to note that the Federal Open Market Committee does not set banking regulation. Right. That's something that's done by these board members in Washington, and it's sort of their sole purview. They don't, no one else has control over it. And so I think it's going to be really, really important to see who gets put in those positions and to make sure, for the Trump administration, to make sure that those positions get filled in a timely manner.
A word here of which there will be many written and said about Janet Yellen's legacy. It's worth the mention that she's the first Fed chair to leave without a recession in I don't even know how long.
Also, to be fair, though, I think it's worth noting that she's the first Fed chair to only serve one term since 1979. So, to be fair, it's been a while since that's happened.
Yeah, and that kind of goes along with what's been happening here, right? Is that Mr. Trump decided he wanted somebody else and Janet Yellen wasn't it.
Absolutely. And to your previous point, though, I do think it's worth noting that she certainly has presided over a period of massive economic calm. And she also engineered the exit from this massive quantitative easing program, which I think is probably what people are going to remember her for. You know, we were facing an unprecedented era of monetary policy that Ben Bernanke presided over. And he really sort of handed over that legacy to Janet Yellen, and she exited from it in a way that didn't roil markets and sort of, you know, saw steady and continued expansion. So I think that's worth noting.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, she will be in the job until the Senate confirms Mr. Powell. Gina Smilak at Bloomberg. Gina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, the bias was to the upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The White House has asked Congress to pass another big disaster relief package, the third in this year of hurricanes and wildfires. It would bring the total appropriation so far to almost $100 billion, and yet the government is being criticized for not offering nearly enough aid. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains how disasters get turned into dollars.
As soon as disaster's on the radar, FEMA starts spending to pre-position emergency personnel and supplies. After the disaster, FEMA and local agencies kick into gear to start delivering relief, says Edward Richards at Louisiana State Law School.
At the first pass, you basically want to fill a big bucket of money up for FEMA to do acute relief, to provide food, shelter, temporary housing.
Then, he says, technical experts swoop in to start assessing longer-term needs.
Doing a fairly comprehensive survey could take months.
And that's about where we are now. Local and federal officials looking at bridges, hospitals, neighborhoods, coming back to Congress and the administration and saying what it'll cost to rebuild. Only, as Adam Rose, an expert on disaster economics at the University of Southern California, points out,
it then gets into politics. You know, the federal treasury is strained. Things are all coming at once.
And so members of Congress from disaster-struck regions lobby their colleagues who control the purse strings. Take Florida's devastated citrus groves. Hurricane Irma caused $750 million in damage. Jess Moore, chief of staff to Republican Congressman Tom Rooney, says her boss has been meeting with federal ag officials, party leaders,
to plead with everyone who will listen to him the urgency and necessity of providing immediate relief.
That money hasn't made it into any disaster bills yet, but she says they'll keep trying. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Congress may well be on its Thanksgiving recess, but tax overhaul news waits for no one. The House bill, which, remember, has passed the full chamber, would change some things about paying for college. The Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation says rolling back some higher education benefits is going to add more than $70 billion to government revenues and so help the GOP as it tries to pay for $1.5 trillion in tax cuts. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, the extra revenue comes at a cost for a lot of students.
The student loan interest deduction is the kind you can get even if you don't itemize. As long as you don't earn too much, you can deduct up to $2,500 in interest off your taxable income.
I would say most middle-income taxpayers who have student loan interest are able to take the deduction.
Donna Bobek-Schmidt is an accounting professor at the University of South Carolina. She ran the numbers on eliminating the education loan interest deduction and says there's actually not that much of a hit.
It's more than made up for by the increase in the standard deduction and the lower tax rates. So to me, that's a smaller issue than the tuition waiver for graduate students.
The elimination of that tuition waiver is worrying a lot of people in higher education. Kenneth Meegan is with the Bipartisan Policy Center. He says lots of students, particularly graduate students, get a stipend while they are in school.
And then on top of that, they get free tuition. Now, this tuition is not counted as taxable income under the current system, but the House proposal would count this.
That could really hit students in STEM fields, says Karen Fisher. She's with the Association of American Medical Colleges and says many of their students get those tuition waivers.
And having them receive a tax on that tuition waiver would really dramatically undermine the research career pipeline.
These changes are just in the House version of the tax bill. The Senate is working on its own version. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Angela Merkel has had better weekends, that much seems clear. Her talks to form a coalition government collapsed last night, leaving the biggest economy in Europe not so much on the ropes, but definitely in an uncertain and unfamiliar place. Reporter Eric Graydon is based in Berlin. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you.
This is obviously a political story, but there are some fundamental economic issues behind it, right?
Sure. Well, I mean, economics are a massive problem here. And obviously, that was one of the factors that was also kind of palpable during the elections. Obviously, a lot of the publicity around the various parties that were contending, and especially the rise of the AfD, was about Merkel's migrant policy. But behind that is the sense of economic injustice. And certainly, that is still a big factor here.
The fallout probably won't be seen for a couple of days. There hasn't been much movement in the markets or the exchange rates. And while there will be some time to let this thing settle out, walk me through what happens if there cannot be a coalition formed. Then what?
Well, I mean, the basic problem is that anything that requires a government coordination, policy decision, just won't happen. And that will slowly but surely start to manifest itself as an economic factor. We have to obviously remember that the fundamentals in Germany are very, very strong, and employment here is as low as it's ever been. So the levels at which we currently stand are very promising and are also very forgiving in terms of, you know, a delay in political decision making. But obviously, at some point, that will be a problem.
Talk to me about the pan-European issue here, right? I mean, what does this mean for President Macron? What does it mean for the Italian economy, some of the rest of them who have been factors in Europe's economy in the past couple of years?
Well, basically, these countries will face a period of prolonged uncertainty, especially if we look at the example of Emmanuel Macron. 2 days after the German election, he laid out ambitious plans for Europe, wanted to create a European finance ministry. None of this can happen until there is a German government that is actually capable of making these sorts of decisions and, importantly, obviously has a mandate to make those decisions. As of yet, we don't have that, and that will be a problem for the whole of Europe.
Just to be clear here, Chancellor Merkel has said she prefers new elections rather than trying to hobble along with minority government, right?
Well, yes, but that will then create a situation where we see drastic uncertainty for even longer, namely until these elections have taken place. Today, for example, there was a statement from one of the big economic think tanks here in Germany called the IFO Institute, and their leader said that he personally preferred a minority government simply because examples in Canada or the Netherlands had shown that those could work fine and might actually produce more stability than the situation we would face if there were to be a new election. The situation as at the moment is open. We don't know how it's going to pan out, and there's still just enormous amounts of uncertainty.
Eric Graydon in Berlin. Eric, thanks very much for your time.
No problem at all.
Coming up.
My training was in math, and I kind of picked up my engineering on the streets. It's true.
One of the original bad boys of virtual reality. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 72 points today, about 0.3%, finished at 23,430. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ rose 7 points, 0.1%, 67.90. The S&P 500 up 0.3%, 25.82. Uber announced a deal to purchase tens of thousands of self-driving cars from Volvo. Tesla dropped 2% on that. Ford Motor Company accelerated 0.9%. General Motors gassed up 2.2% today. Holiday travel time, and nearly 51 million Americans are going to hit the road, rails, and air, according to AAA. American Airlines nosed up 0.6% today. Delta down less than 0.1%, basically flat. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.36%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You can't spell antitrust without the letters A, T, and T, and therein lies the corporate regulatory story of this Monday. This afternoon, the Justice Department announced it is going to try to block the $85 billion merger of AT&T and Time Warner. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has been covering the story for us. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
So lay out the logic of this lawsuit that the Justice Department is going to file, would you?
Sure. So the anti-competitive argument goes something like this, that the merged company would be really powerful and that AT&T could use Time Warner content to force its competitors to pay more for that content. So that might mean higher TV bills or fewer options for consumers. That's what the DOJ has to prove here, that this would somehow harm consumers. Of course, AT&T does not agree with that. Right. Their position is that this is something called a vertical merger, that they're a distribution company, they're buying a content company, they're not taking over a competitor, so there shouldn't be an antitrust issue here. AT&T actually called this in a statement today. They called the lawsuit a radical and inexplicable departure from decades of antitrust precedent.
Yeah, Randall Stephenson, the CEO of AT&T, was irate, I think you could say, in his statements about this lawsuit. Let me ask you this, though. It's going to go to trial. A judge will figure it out. The president of the United States, before he even took office, said, we are not going to allow this merger to happen. He has let be known his displeasure with CNN, owned by Time Warner. Talk to me about how this is going to play out now in the court of public opinion, really, but also in the legal courts in the next, 6 months.
Right. So the politics of this certainly don't help the DOJ. It doesn't help the appearance of their case. When it goes to court, presumably the judge will be focused on the legal argument, right, and the DOJ will have to spell out a specific legal argument and the analysis that they've done to back it up to say how this is going to hurt consumers.
Tweets are policy, right? I mean, that's the White House has said that.
Trump has been very clear. He does not want this deal to go through.
Tracy Samuelson in New York for us. Thank you, Tracy.
Thanks, Kai.
For all the attention the big Wall Street banks get, there are broad chunks of this economy for which traditional banking services might as well not exist. New immigrants are among those groups. They often arrive without American credit or an employment history. So for hundreds of years, immigrant communities in this country have turned to what are called lending clubs to get capital. The idea is simple. Everybody puts money in a pot, and then that pot is paid out to individuals on a rotating basis. But as Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains, the clubs are not without some risk.
When Chinese immigrants in Brooklyn's Sunset Park are burned by lending clubs, they come to see John Chan.
Hey, looking for John Chan?
No, police.
Chan's office is on the third floor of Golden Imperial Palace, a giant dim sum hall he owns. Chan's a respected leader in the community, president of the nonprofit Asian American Communities Empowerment. His office walls are covered with framed photos, Chan with different VIPs. The two Clintons, the two Bushes, a third Bush whose name he can't quite remember. Jeb, I think they call him.
Jeb?
Chan acknowledges that lending clubs cause problems even he can't solve, despite his sway with local politicians and law enforcement. But the clubs have also transformed his neighborhood. Since Chan got to Brooklyn in the early 2000s, the Asian population has nearly doubled. They're now the fastest growing group in the borough. We walk over with the translator to 8th Avenue, a mile-long stretch of Chinese-owned businesses.
10 years ago, this street, no one even, walked down it. And now, if you want to get some real estate here, you can't even forget about it.
There are pool halls, karaoke joints, hot pot restaurants. Under construction is a 20,000-square-foot hotel. Chan says probably 70% of these businesses were capitalized via lending clubs. Not technically illegal, these clubs are essentially informal banks. Everyone throws money into a pot with one person, the banker, if you will, in charge. The banker then lends out the pot to different members on a rotating basis, with varying interest rates based on how much money you need and how soon you need it. Ron Kim is a state assemblyman who represents another big Chinatown in Flushing, Queens. He says his neighborhood would look completely different without lending club money.
It's mind-boggling when there's $2-3 million condos that's being sold, but these apartments are being sold all in cash with no mortgages.
Easy access to big piles of cash is exactly what makes lending clubs so attractive and so dangerous, says Democratic Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, who represents Sunset Park and other New York neighborhoods.
There is not a formal contract
There is no oversight. There is no guarantee that a person will not disappear with the money or that some of the borrowers will be able to pay back the money that was lent to them.
Both of those things happened in Velasquez's district recently. In one case, the organizer of the club, the banker, ran off with $2 million. In another case, some participants stopped making their payments, which brought the $20 million club crashing down. Velasquez has been holding financial literacy events across her district to educate recent immigrants about their consumer rights and encourage them to use microlenders or traditional banks. But Ivan Light, a professor emeritus at UCLA who's studied lending clubs for decades, says this misses the point.
If you're a foreign-born person, you don't have a credit history in this country, you don't have a high income, you have no assets, how are you going to get a loan from a bank?
Light says such clubs have existed across cultures for hundreds of years, and they're not going away anytime soon. In Mexico, they're called tandas. In China, biahue. In India, chit funds. This makes lending clubs older than the U.S. banking system itself. In Brooklyn, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
With the stipulation that there are always a lot of new tech trends going on in Silicon Valley, one of the most enduring is virtual reality. Facebook and Google, everybody who is anybody in Silicon Valley is getting into it. The thing is, VR has been around way longer than you might know. Jaron Lanier founded VPL Research, one of the first companies to release consumer-focused VR products, in 1984. His new book on the past and future of virtual reality is called The Dawn of Everything. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
You have been around this world for a very long time, and I want you to take me back to, 1984, when your first company got started and you really kind of dug in. And remind people what the entire idea of virtual reality was like back then.
Well, back then, there had already been a virtual reality headset or two created in labs. There wasn't yet anything like a normal product for virtual reality. There wasn't anything you could buy. There wasn't anything that didn't have like bolts and rails sticking out of it. So I started the first VR company to make that stuff.
And now here we are 30X years later, and you still have to strap something to your head. It's still not entirely real. Did you think we would be farther along?
Well, not really. I mean, I had predicted that there would be consumer virtual reality of a preliminary sort by 2020. And so it's maybe a little ahead of schedule, but it's approximately where I thought I'd be.
But when you put, like, I mean, let's just pick a name brand, right? When you put the Oculus Rift on your head, are you pleased with how things look? Both literally inside the headset and then as an industry.
Well, I'm fine with how they look. I'm a little less fine with how they feel. I feel as though the current crop of VR products focus a little too much on the visual side and not enough on what you do with your hands and with your body, because that's really where the action is.
Okay, so why aren't we doing that stuff? Is it just too technologically hard?
You know, it's probably true that the what we call the haptic side, the touch and feel side, yeah, of virtual reality is more technically challenging than the visual side. But I think there's also just this visual dominance problem. People, especially I think the kinds of people who become digital engineers, are pretty visually dominant and tend to just give the eyes, the pride of place.
It's interesting you talk about engineers in that way, because you are not technically a trained engineer, right? You're a guy who's been in this for a long time and sort of learned from the ground up.
My training was in math, and I kind of picked up my engineering on the streets. It's true.
on the streets. Can you pick up engineering on the streets? I don't even know.
Well, sometimes you have to, so that's the way it works, yeah.
Virtual reality is not, you say, a consistent thing, right? It has fits and starts, it goes forward, and then it stops. Is there a chance, do you think, that we could actually see some real tangible progress like we have seen with laptops and mobile devices and stuff?
I'm actually really confident in terms of the basic hardware. I'm a little less confident about the cultural aspects of it. Right now, the way we sell the experiences is like as downloads that somebody might just experience in a dark room. And that kind of bothers me. It should be more of a service where people connect together in fantastical ways. But I think we'll get there.
But you do have that problem, right, of even if people are connecting inside the virtual world, let's say in an office and you're having a meeting or whatever, you're still sitting around with a headset on your face and somebody else is walking by on the way to the coffee machine going, what? You know?
I know a lot of people think, wow, that's a weird thing to put this giant, bizarre object on your head. But to me, it's what makes virtual reality ethical, because when you have this big thing on your head, the illusion is announced. You know, that means it's a magic show instead of a charlatan taking advantage of you. Like the point is to let you know this is an illusion. So I hope they never get small and convenient. I think they should be ugly and a little awkward.
The key word with virtual reality then being virtual, right? Because it's just not real.
No, it's a form of communication. I mean, it's real in the sense that what we express through it can be real, but it's a thing to enjoy within reality. It's not an alternate or a substitute reality.
Jaron Lanier, his book is called Dawn of the New Everything. Jaron, thanks a lot.
Oh, hey, thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, about which two things. Number one, if you've got kids nearby who still believe, if you know what I mean, cover their ears for like 30 seconds. Okay. Done that? All right, good. Now, number two, if you ask me, I think Macy's has lost the spirit of Christmas. At the retailer's flagship store in Herald Square in New York this year, you're going to have to make an appointment for your kid to sit on Santa's lap. Santa is a popular guy, Macy's wrote on its website, so the wait times to meet him have been quite long in previous years, especially on our busiest days, end quote. I mean, I get that, but yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He's available between 3 and 3:35 next Tuesday. All right, that is all we got. The Dow up 72 on this Monday, 0.3%. NASDAQ up 7, 0.1%. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, about 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Haley Hirschman, and Daisy Palacios. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.